This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about a recent ACLU of Georgia report on immigration detention facilities.
The main detention facility down in Georgia, outside of Atlanta, is owned by a private corporation called the Correction Corporation of America. Let's hope their stock goes down.
We'll talk about punitive HIV laws that prosecute individuals merely because of their HIV status.
HIV criminalization laws do little to stem the epidemic or protect public health. Instead, they often backfire and discourage people from being tested.
As part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, we're joined by Daniel Gross.
Daniel's a young Lawyers Guild attorney who founded some years ago Focus on the Food Chain and Brand Workers, and has had a number of successes in organizing the most exploited, poorest, largely immigrant workers in the food chain here in New York City.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, we have a bit of good news. A federal appeals court has revived two lawsuits by former Iraqi detainees, claiming that civilian interrogators and translators actually participated in their torture at Abu Ghraib prison. You'll remember Titan Corporation, which is now called L3 Services, and Kaki International were sued by the Center for Constitutional Rights.
On behalf of a number of people who were tortured, I think 70-some, the case was thrown out but then revived. Appellate court said we just need more information before we can make a decision. So let's not light the candles yet. But this was a good development considering the Fourth Circuit isn't the most renowned in democratic liberties circles.
And I think the point we should be happy for is that it will allow the cases to go forward in the lower courts and that stories from the detainees can be made public. Hopefully some modicum of justice will result.
I totally agree. Anytime you can shine the spotlight of public opinion on these practices, it's a win for the good guys.
Michael, we have a disturbing situation involving Palestinian prisoners who are being held in detention with no trial.
Administrative detention, which means that the Israelis have put several thousand Palestinians in prison with no charges, no trial, no date to get out, no visitors, solitary confinement, strip searches, no education, the most horrible of conditions. And it, remarkably, 2,000 Palestinian prisoners went on a hunger strike, some of them on a hunger strike for 76 days, near death, and we got the good news last week that the hunger strike has been called off, that the Israelis have relented on some of the demands. It's not clear yet exactly what's happening. I suspect that they're going to allow some visitation, that they're going to allow education. Whether or not they're going to bring charges or release these people is still up in the air.
Clarify their crime.
Protesters and organizers against the Israeli occupation. Coincidentally, last week was the Palestinian anniversary of the Nakba, which in Arabic means the catastrophe. It goes back to May of 1948 when the Israeli state was established, and through means of terror, some 500 Palestinian villages were cleared of their people. The Palestinians were ethnically cleansed and driven out. Some 750 Palestinians were driven out. They haven't been allowed to come back. Their property was confiscated. And then in 1967, to extend it, the Israelis grabbed land on the West Bank and in Jerusalem. In violation of the Geneva Accords of international law, they've been settling that. So these Palestinians who are on this extraordinary hunger strike have been protesting the increasing gobbling up of the last remaining Palestinian land. Pretty soon, there's going to be nothing left of historic Palestine. You could say, well, then the one-state solution becomes inevitable. I suppose it does. But what the Israelis want to do is keep the Palestinians in a segregated apartheid situation. And this strike, which is unparalleled in history, to have 2,000 prisoners in solitary coordinating a hunger strike and willing to die, quite brave and noble of the Palestinians. And they've gotten solidarity from all around the world, including the National Lawyers Guild.
That's right, Michael. Well, we hope the best for them.
main detention facility down in Georgia, outside of Atlanta, is owned by a private corporation called the Correction Corporation of America. Azadeh Shoshani, you're the project director with the Georgia ACLU on prison conditions, prisons run by the CCA. What does that stand for? Who are these people? Let's talk about that first.
CCA stands for Corrections Corporation of America, which is the largest prison corporation in the U.S.
You mean this is a private corporation?
Yes.
You can own stock in a corporation that runs prisons?
Right. Currently, about 49% of immigrants are detained in facilities operated by corporations.
And how about in Georgia?
In Georgia, there are 4 immigration detention facilities. 3 of them are operated by corporations.
You folks at the ACLU have done an investigation of the conditions in these places. Yes. Heidi and I wanted to ask you about what you've uncovered.
We started this investigation actually in late summer 2008. So for more than 3 years, we interviewed 68 detainees at the facilities in Georgia. We also interviewed immigration attorneys, family members of detainees, reviewed records that we obtained from the government. We also toured all 4 immigration detention centers. What we discovered was serious abuses in Georgia detention centers requiring immediate action.
I understand that you were denied access to certain parts of the facilities.
Right, which was very problematic. At the Stewart Detention Center and the Irving County Detention Center, we were not able to see the segregation unit, which, you know, obviously raises a red flag, because based on what we've been hearing from the detainees held at the segregation unit, there are huge problems in terms of detainees being denied basic privileges and also, you know, the human dignity at these segregation units.
What is a segregation unit? How does it differ from the normal unit?
It's a unit designed for placement of detainees which may have violated disciplinary rules. But what we also discovered was that in some cases, detainees with mental health issues, instead of receiving the treatment that they were owed, are placed in segregation because apparently the facility doesn't know what else to do. And in some cases, also transgender detainees are placed in segregation.
Do you think that lack of proper care and so on can be related to the fact that this is a for-profit corporation that's running these units?
Definitely. I mean, the profit motive behind these detention centers is a major factor. I mean, for one thing, 2 of the facilities run by the Corrections Corporation of America, detainees can enroll in a so-called voluntary work program, but we haven't spoken to detainees who said that they felt that they were forced to work even when they were not feeling well, they were injured. For this work, they are given $1 to $3 a day, so really sub-minimum wages for the work that they perform.
You could say that again. Did you do these interviews yourself or supervise them?
I did some interviews myself, and others were conducted by volunteer attorneys.
Azadeh, we're curious about how Georgia compares to other states in terms of the conditions of detention facilities. Do you have a perspective on that?
You know, investigation was limited to Georgia, so I can't speak as much to conditions elsewhere, but from what we know, detention conditions all over the U.S. are lacking. Detainees are being denied basic human dignity, and this runs counter to the promises of the Obama administration of reforming the system fundamentally such that it turns into a civil detention model rather than a punitive detention, which is what it is right now. I mean, you walk into these facilities and they are jails. I mean, these are prisons. It really has nothing to do with so-called civil detention.
Is the ACLU making any specific demands for reform?
Yes, we are. We have a set of specific recommendations. 2 of our main recommendations is for ICE to stop detaining immigrants at the Stewart Detention Center and the Irving County Detention Center. Both of them are run by corporations. Because of the extent of documented violations at these 2 facilities and because of the distance to families, communities of support, and legal representation. So both of these facilities are more than 3 hours away from Atlanta.
And how many people are we talking about that are under control of these facilities?
Well, at Stewart alone, there's about 1,750 detainees that are being held at the facility. I should mention that Stewart is currently the largest immigration detention center in the country.
And where do these people come from? What's kind of a typical profile of a person in there? Age, country?
Well, you know, many of them are from Latin American countries, so Mexico, but also Central American countries, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. But we have also interviewed people originally from Africa, from the Caribbean, from the Middle East, from South Asia, from East Asia, really from all over the world. And people also come from all across the Southeast.
And what's the age range?
It was wide. I mean, we have interviewed elderly detainees as well as people in their 20s.
And what's the average amount of time that a detainee is put in one of these facilities?
You know, it really depends. I would say probably the shortest amount of time is about 2 months. So for people who are not fighting their case and all they're asking for is to be allowed to go back to their country of origin, it's about 2 months, but it could be longer than that. But for people who are fighting their cases, that, you know, they have a claim to allow them to stay in the U.S. because they fear torture if returned to their country of origin, they could have stayed in there for years.
Atzadeh, this is really good work that you folks are doing at the ACLU in Georgia. Do you have a website if people want to know more about it?
Definitely. People can go to acluga.org.
Say that one more time.
ACLUGA.org.
Atzadeh Shoshani, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me.
Bye, Atzadeh. Take care.
Bye-bye.
We talked today about HIV-specific criminal laws and sentencing enhancements. HIV criminal prosecution occurs when an HIV-positive individual does not disclose his or her HIV status to a partner before engaging in sex. The person charged may face decades in prison, lifetime registration as a sex offender, and great stigmatization. While there have been hundreds of prosecutions for HIV crimes in the United States, disclosure and consent is a defense, but is very difficult to prove. Actual transmission of HIV is unnecessary. We talked today with Sean Strub, founder of the Sero Project, to help oppose the use of HIV-specific criminal legislation. Sean points out in his articles that a stigma driven by HIV criminalization has created a viral underclass with rights inferior to other people. Sean, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
I suspect that most people are unaware of some pretty strict laws for individuals who are HIV positive and engage in sexual activity. Can you briefly give us an overview of the legislation existing right now?
Sure. About 35 or 36 states and territories have HIV-specific statutes that only apply to people with HIV that mandate disclosure of their HIV status prior to engaging in intimate contact with another person. It's independent of whether or not there's any risk present, independent of whether there's any harm actually incurred, and independent of any intent to harm.
And the harm being transmission of HIV.
Correct. The statutes have created sort of a viral underclass in the law that is, I think, pretty concerning. And we generally agree that creating different laws for people based on their skin color or their gender or sexual orientation is not a very good idea. But right now there's an explosion of laws based on people's viral status.
So give us an example here. Someone could be prosecuted merely for having sex and not disclosing their status, even if the other person did not contract the virus.
Sure. Well, actually, the vast majority of the prosecutions do not involve transmission of the virus. Transmission of the virus occurs in only a very small number of the prosecutions. There are also a lot of prosecutions fall within the phenomenon we call HIV criminalization that aren't necessarily about sex, but that are sort of heightened charges for other behaviors, like Willie Campbell, a man in Texas, serving 35 years for spitting at a cop because the court found his saliva to be a deadly weapon, even though saliva doesn't transmit HIV. But the sexual, the non-disclosure cases, I interviewed a man in prison in Idaho a couple of weeks ago who was 3 years into a 30-year sentence. He did not transmit HIV. He used a condom, and he had an undetectable viral load. There was no risk of transmission. This was just a law and a prosecution based on ignorance and fear and stigma.
And he's doing 30 years in prison.
He's 3 years into a 30-year sentence.
It's unbelievable. 20. The irrationality of this really strikes you. And the counterproductivity also, Sean. I mean, it would seem to me then that people would rather not know that they are HIV positive because then they could be charged. So they don't take the test.
Well, this is one of the reasons I think the issue is starting to get a little bit of traction, is that for a long time people thought of this in sort of that range of horrific injustices, but there seems to be a long list of those, and unfortunately much of the society is able to kind of turn a blind eye to that. But we've been really alerting people to the fact that this is horrific public health policy as well, that it's increasingly, you hear, take the test and risk arrest. We know that once people get tested for HIV, if they find out they have it, they are much more responsible and safe in their sexual behaviors than people who have HIV who do not know it. Yet you can't be prosecuted if you don't know you have it. So the best defense against an HIV criminalization prosecution is not getting tested, not knowing your status in the first place.
And let's explain that a bit further for listeners. In some states, state health officials require signing forms in which HIV-positive persons acknowledge potential liability. So if you know in certain states that you're HIV-positive, you actually have to sign a form. It's sort of like registering all HIV-positive individuals. Is that right?
Well, there is now registration of all HIV-positive individuals. And the form, whether one signs the form or not, the results are reported to the state. So the state now knows who has been given a positive test. However, what has happened in the last several years is that more and more states, and in many cases county health departments, they present a form to someone very often moments after they test positive, when they're in a period of distress. Many people go into a state of semi-shock, and they pass this form across the table and say, oh, you need to sign this to acknowledge that you've been counseled and you've been told your HIV status. In some cases, they require someone sign that form in order to access services. And that form very often will cite the statute in that state, the criminal statute, and it says, this is if you don't disclose, these are the penalties and so on. And what that does, in addition to being a real violation of people's rights, they're not, they don't have access to counsel at that moment. It's implied that they must sign this, which, of course, they are not legally obligated to sign that. They're signing away rights in that. But it also, it enters the prospect of prosecution at a point when somebody is very fragile. They've just been told they're positive. They're being given this form, and their first reaction is, well, he didn't tell me he was positive. And this is driving a lot of the prosecutions, because right at that moment, it brings up the prospect of blaming somebody, of it being someone else's responsibility, that there should be someone who should have to pay, someone who should be prosecuted. And a number of these cases that I've been familiar with, the charges were filed by someone who then a few days, a few weeks, a few months later, maybe thinks a little differently about it. They might be angry, they might have felt deceived, whatever, but they didn't want the other person really to go to prison for 15, 20, 25. A man in Iowa just had a 50-year sentence upheld. These forms are driving the criminalization specifically, as well as contributing to this stigmatization that makes people reluctant to get tested, reluctant to disclose, reluctant to access treatment.
How is disclosure between two individuals in a private situation proved in a court of law? Unless you have someone sign a consent form or waiver.
Well, the people chuckle about that, but in fact, that is what some people with HIV are doing. The AIDS Law Project in Louisiana has been distributing a form, an affidavit, encouraging people to have their partners sign that prior to engaging in intimate contact. Other people will take a partner with them to a doctor's office or a therapist or whatever and ask it to be noted in the records that they were disclosed to. Or people save text messages and email messages, or they disclose in front of a third party. At PAWS magazine, we did an online survey that a couple thousand people with HIV completed, and it was about a range of issues. And this wasn't specifically in a legal context, but it just said, in the course of your life, have you had a situation where you believed you had disclosed your own HIV-positive status, and then before having sex with someone, and then later your partner indicated that they didn't understand that you were positive? And 28% of the respondents said that had happened to them in their lives. This happens a lot. You know, people use sometimes a vernacular that may not be understood by another, or, you know, well, of course they knew I was positive. I'm an AIDS activist. My meds were, you know, on the kitchen counter. There's a copy of POS magazine on the coffee table. What do they mean they didn't know I was positive? So there are all sorts of circumstances that lead to these. Many of the cases are revenge cases. But it's also these states that have HIV-specific statutes, they don't have a specific statute for hepatitis or for HPV or for other kinds of sexually transmitted pathogens, which, if left untreated, can be very harmful to people. 4,000 women in the U.S. last year died of cervical cancer. Almost every single one of them got it from human papillomavirus, HPV, genital warts. Someone gave that virus to them. But we're not out prosecuting people for failing to disclose HPV or hepatitis or whatever. And, you know, the reason is obvious. Those sexually transmitted diseases aren't associated with an outlaw sexuality. They're not associated with people of color or with gay men or with anal intercourse or with people who use drugs. And because HIV is, it's held out in this exceptional way, in this you know, intense stigmatization and criminalization. The phenomenon, by the way, is far greater than anything that has been reported anywhere. The number that's used in the U.S. by the UN and International Planned Parenthood Federation and lots of efforts that are starting to look at this issue is 345 prosecutions. We've always known that was a minimum number. There's no central database of these. But through the SARO Project, the effort I'm working with, we've been filing hundreds of Freedom of Information Act requests state by state, county by county. And in just six or seven states, we're up to over 600 occasions when charges were filed under HIV-specific statutes. So there are many, many more of these cases, and they're happening at a faster rate. You know, there's now, it seems to be, a new criminalization case just about every week.
Sean, we've read the excellent introduction that you wrote to the article on this criminalization of HIV-positive people in POS magazine, that's P-O-Z. The June issue of this year has the introduction that you wrote. You write about three various people, two men and a woman, that have been prosecuted for this. And I wanted you to, in a nutshell, can you tell one or two of these stories so people get an idea of the victimizations of these people?
Sure. One of the things, when I really started devoting a lot of attention to this issue, you know, 3 years ago, and it became the primary focus of my advocacy, I was frustrated because even when we, you know, found occasions to talk about the issue, they were never hearing from people it had actually happened to. And very often, it's the last thing they want to talk about. You know, they've been on their local television stations called an AIDS monster and an AIDS predator with wildly hysterical and incredibly inaccurate coverage. But I started reaching out, sort of developing relationships with some people who had been prosecuted, and filmed a number of them for a short film, HIV is Not a Crime, on YouTube, to kind of make it, to personalize the issue. And the three people in the article in POS this month and in my film, Nick Rhodes, a young man from Iowa, where I also happen to be from, who met a guy online, they hooked up. Nick used a condom, he had an undetectable viral load. He was sentenced to 25 years in prison. Fortunately, after a year, with a lot of letters and efforts from advocates around the world, the judge reconsidered that sentence and let him out. But he has lifetime sex offender registration in a really extreme way that is just horrific, medieval, actually, when you understand the nuance of it. Monique Moray, a woman in Charleston, South Carolina, found out she was positive when she was pregnant. She was in the military. She was in the middle of a divorce. She had acquired the virus from her husband. She didn't know he had acquired it. And a few months later, she hooked up with another soldier. And she told him to use a condom, which he went to the court and said, she told me to use a condom. I'm, you know, I'm a big boy. He didn't want her prosecuted. And fortunately, the charges against her were dropped. But she was kicked out of the Army, and she was, you know, humiliated in her local community and is sort of held up in this public way as this AIDS monster or whatever.
Are you saying that the individual she had sex with didn't necessarily want her prosecuted?
Oh, he did not want her prosecuted. He said he was responsible for his own actions.
Brought the charges against her?
In her case, it was the Army.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
And the third case in the thing, and I have to tell you what each of these individuals has done subsequently, because that's the really inspiring part. Third person was a man named Robert Suttle, who was in a contentious relationship in Louisiana. He's from Shreveport. And when he and his partner broke up, the partner had threatened to go to the police and report Robert for not having initially disclosed when they first met. And that's exactly what he did when they broke up. And Robert, you know, as he said, where he's from, someone with his skin color can expect to get the maximum sentence if they go to trial. So Robert took a plea and served 6 months in prison and asked to register as a sex offender for 15 years. Robert actually found me when he was getting out of prison by a friend who was taking him home. He didn't know there was advocacy around this issue. He didn't even know the phenomenon had a name, HIV criminalization. He said, as he knew, an injustice had been done to him. And as his grandfather, who was a deacon in his Baptist church, said, your misery is your ministry. And he said, this was his life now. So he got home that evening and got online and started doing some research and found something I had written and found my phone number. And with 48 hours of his release from prison, he had me on the phone, and he said, I want to do whatever I can to help. I don't know what I can do to help, but this is my life now, and here I am. And over the past year, Robert has become an incredibly effective advocate, speaking at UN events and at community events around the country, and is now working with me full-time at the Sero Project. Nick Rhodes, the young man from Iowa, is now working with the Center for HIV Law and Policy's Positive Justice Project as an outreach and event coordinator. The Positive Justice Project is a collaboration of which I and the Sero Project are part of about 40 or 50 organizations and individuals, a lot of public health people, a lot of attorneys, a lot of policy people working to change these statutes. And so Nick is now working as an advocate as well. And Monique opened a testing and drop-in and support center in Holly Hills, South Carolina, a small community about 45 miles from the nearest HIV services, and is also speaking out on the issue as well. So these are the first three people who've been criminalized who have turned a pretty awful experience into advocacy, and they've had a profound influence over the last 6 or 7 months as the issue has become personalized. You know, it's not abstract. It's not, you know, horrific cases that are sensationalized by hysterical media. These are real people whose lives have been turned upside down by a horrific injustice, which, by the way, and unfortunately, the United States is leading the world in. We are the capital of HIV criminalization and have exported it all around the world.
Sean, I wanted to share with our listeners what Nick Rhodes had to say about what happened to him. You get an idea of just how awful this is. After he was convicted, he says he was required to register with authorities as a sex offender and report to them every 3 months. I cannot be around minors, even family members, without their parents' supervision. All my computers, texts, and phone records, and those of anyone living in my home, can be confiscated at any time. I'm not allowed to have casual sex, watch pornography, or use social networking sites. I may not leave my county without permission or the state without a travel permit. I have a midnight curfew. I may not have liquor in my home or visit a bar. I must take an invasive polygraph test every 6 months and visit my probation officer every 2 weeks. And he's been threatened with having to have a phallometric testing, which he says he thinks involves attaching some device to his penis to measure his sexual response. I mean, this is unbelievable. PAS magazine has done a great service for every American by exposing this. And I wanted to ask you if you could share with our listeners how you get a hold of both PAS magazine and how do you contact the Sero Project?
Sure. PAS magazine is PAS.com. The Sero Project is S-E-R-O, SeroProject.com. The lie detector test that Nick has to take has to detail every sexual contact, when he met the person, what they did, when he disclosed, how often they did it. He has to answer questions about whether he's attracted to sex with children or to wearing women's clothing or sex with animals. There's a whole series of unbelievably demeaning questions. And because his victim was a man, and by the way, Nick, Monique, Robert, none of them were accused of transmitting HIV. But in Iowa, because Nick's victim was the same sex, he he's automatically in a higher risk of sex offender registration, which is why the more onerous restrictions.
They put that on your driver's license.
Well, Robert, not in Iowa, they don't, but with Robert in Louisiana, they do. On his driver's license, in big red capital letters underneath his photograph, it says sex offender. At a UNAIDS event in Geneva, Switzerland, Robert wore his driver's license as a name tag, and we're just shocked. Robert has now moved from Louisiana to Milford, Pennsylvania, where I live, and is living in an apartment near me and my partner and working with me full-time at the Sero Project. But he had to register in Pennsylvania, and that necessitated our local police chief to go door-to-door in our neighborhood to every household within several hundred feet and to every church and school and daycare center within a mile with a flyer with Robert's photograph and warning, sex offender, Megan's Law. This is in a little town of 1,100 people, and this was for behavior between consenting adults, and he is stigmatized in this horrific way. Robert, because of who he is and his extraordinary courage, Robert wrote a long piece for our local paper, and I wrote a piece for the paper as well, and they published it. We decided to do our own community notification. And he starts out by saying, I'm not a criminal, and I'm not a sex offender, but the state of Louisiana says I am.
This has been an extraordinary interview, and I think it really reflects and shines a spotlight on a very antiquated, fearful society here that has stigmatized innocent individuals and branded them.
Well, thank you. There are a lot of us working to change these statutes now, including the Positive Justice Project and SARO and a lot of partner organizations, and we're going to need some help. So if your listeners are able to, we're eager to engage them.
You can count on us, Sean. Good luck, and thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Sean.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Continue for Brand Workers, a nonprofit organization protecting and advancing the rights of retail and food employees. Last fall, we talked with attorney Daniel Gross, executive director of Brand Workers, about the $470,000 settlement reached in a labor dispute with PurePak, a food distribution warehouse giant that illegally withheld wages from their workers. Today, we discuss the latest victory in another settlement recovering nearly $600,000 in unpaid wages and compensation for workers at Flom Appetizing. According to Daniel Gross, the Latino workers there were subjected to constant verbal harassment and forced to work at unsafe speeds. This lawyer you'll like joins us today to talk more about the settlement and how he became a people's lawyer. Welcome back, Daniel, to Law and Disorder.
Good to be here, Heidi. Thank you.
Well, it's rare that we have exciting victories, and we're here to talk about a recent one that you had in New York City. Give us a brief overview of your success.
Yeah, it's good to be here again. I know we talked in the thick of it in a really hard-fought battle. As some people know, not enough. We're getting the word out. New York City has a burgeoning food manufacturing and distribution economy. There's 35,000 workers, a vast majority are immigrant workers of color, and they depend on this sector for their livelihood. Unfortunately, the prevailing business model that's been adopted in this really critical part of our food supply chain that we all depend on to get the food that ultimately ends up at our grocery stores and restaurants, the business model is simple. It's exploiting recent immigrant workers of color through wage theft, through reckless disregard for health and safety, and egregious discrimination against workers from Latin America, from China, Haiti, Nepal, and elsewhere. So Flom regrettably but not surprisingly, really fit the mold. Flom is a hummus manufacturer and distributor of kosher food products based in East Williamsburg, Brooklyn, not far from the fancy boutiques and bars and galleries that Williamsburg is known for. Starts this sector, an industrial corridor of food manufacturing sweatshops. And like many companies in the sector, Flom engaged in a tremendous amount of wage theft, a failure to pay overtime, in some cases minimum wage. You know, millions and millions of dollars in real wealth had been illegally withheld from workers.
Over what period of time are we talking?
Well, Flom itself was actually founded in 1918 by the Flom family. The Flom family sold the company in the late 80s. And that's when I think you see this turn towards sweatshop practices. You think about our members, they send a large portion of their money back home. And that money goes to put, you know, food on the table, to access clean water and shelter. To have that kind of money unlawfully withheld, it's real wealth that really deprives people of the ability to support and help their family thrive. There was really offensive and insulting discrimination against Latino workers, including Latino workers being called cockroaches and aliens, extreme disrespect from the general manager at the plant, and really no serious regard for workers' health and safety, a lack of the appropriate safety equipment. And I think more than anything, the workers being forced to work just grueling, unsafe, at an unsafe speed, 60, 70, 80 hours a week, again, not earning what they were entitled to under the law. So Flom regrettably fit the mold of what's currently the dominant way of doing business in New York City's food processing and distribution economy.
Attorney Daniel Gross from Brand Workers, how did you get the case and how did you develop your tactics and strategy to reverse this situation and get these workers compensated?
You know, the workers had gotten organized essentially on their own, actually in 2007, with the help of some organizers from the industrial workers of the world. And they kind of got started around this issue of wage theft and respect for management, and experienced a tremendous array of retaliatory tactics from the boss, which did deal a momentary setback to their efforts. The Flom workers approached me in 2010 with some hope and energy because they had seen the victory that our members at the Wild Edible Seafood Factory that we've talked about on your show had won. So in 2010, we helped create a space for the workers to develop their own extremely powerful campaign. And there's a lot to be said about the campaign, but I think the most significant things that people should keep in mind were it was a tremendous partnership between the Latino community and progressive forces in the Orthodox Jewish community. Uri Letzedek, which is the movement for social justice in the Orthodox movement, came on as absolutely the most remarkable partner we've had. They helped our members, mostly from Mexico, a couple from El Salvador, do innumerable events at synagogues and community centers, connecting with kosher consumers and letting them know the story of what really was going on at this company that's supposed to uphold the highest of dietary standards, but meanwhile was engaging in really aggressive exploitation. So that was a key factor in eventually bringing this campaign to success. A couple other things I have to mention. The workers, through just incredibly persistent grassroots energy, persuaded over 120 of the best, most prominent grocery stores in New York to stop selling Flom products, including their Sonny and Joe's hummus, until workers' rights are respected. So that helped create a very powerful economic incentive for the company to come back into compliance with the law to try to regain this business.
Daniel, during this process, were there times when you thought you were not going to be victorious?
Well, our commitment at Brand Workers and focus on the food chain, which is the effort to transform the sweatshops in this sector into good, dignified places to work that we carry out with the industrial workers of the world, our commitment is to fight to win. When we engage with an adversary, they should know that we will, if we have to, chase them to the gates of hell and back. Victory is our commitment. We'll be left standing after the campaign. Or they will, but it'll only end one way or the other. It is our commitment to win. The workers, though, of course, we have to acknowledge this really incredible effort, the hours and hours of street protests, the advocacy, the community dialogues. you know, almost all of our members in the FLOM campaign are raising young children. So they're doing 60, 70, 80-hour weeks in a sweatshop and then trying to be the best parents that they can be so their children hopefully have a somewhat better, hopefully a much better life than working in sweatshops. And so it's just incredible to take out that amount of time to meet and strategize and be trained in organizing and legal rights to see a campaign like this through.
Did the campaign have a legal component?
Yes, it had a large-scale set of litigation that was attached to it. One was a federal court case, which was on the question of wage theft. So overtime and to some extent minimum wage and other violations of the wage and hour law, federal and state, that the boss was not in compliance with. Our members had crystal clear memories, which ended up being extremely accurate about working 11, 12, 13-hour days, 6 days a week. And in the discovery process, when we were able to get the employer's records of time work, if anything, our members may have underestimated the incredible hours that they put into the shop. So that was one piece of the litigation.
Going forward, Daniel, how are you going to ensure that FLOM does not go back into its bad practices?
Well, that's what this victory really is all about. So there's two big components that we're able to bring home after what was really a hard-fought struggle. One is our members were very proud to report recovered $577,000, again, in wealth that will help them transform their families' lives both here and in their home countries, Mexico and El Salvador. And they also won a binding code of conduct, which will force a FLOM into full compliance with workplace protections, including health and safety protections and anti-discrimination safeguards. And that's what Focus on the Food Chain is all about. It's all about transforming employers and the industry as a whole.
Who monitors adherence to that code of conduct?
Our membership. And Focus on the Food Chain, we're taking an approach. Some say it's innovative. I wish we could say it was. But our model is really the labor movement of the late 19th century, the early 20th century. Unions like Local 8, the great multiracial IWW union on the Philadelphia docks, that used worker direct action and everyday solidarity to make work better at your workplace, but also to look at the economy as a whole and question why we've become so comfortable in this country shedding our right to liberty and democracy that we insist on, supposedly, at least in the political arena, when we walk into work in the morning. So our members are both making their workplace better, but at the same time, they're building an organized base through the industry and ultimately, hopefully, in partnership with other groups through the economy to really make fundamental change in this country.
Daniel, you have an event coming up?
Yes. As I mentioned, you know, New York City's food processing and distribution sector could be an incredible part of our economy and our society. So many of us, and not just elite white people, as the right would lead you to believe, so many of us are interested in wholesome, local, organic food. And so many of us, of course, are interested in good manufacturing jobs. New York City's food processing distribution sector serves billions and billions of dollars in foodstuffs to grocery stores and restaurants. It could be a sector that we could all be very excited about. Regrettably, though, again, it's based on exploitation of recent immigrants. Our members carried out, with the support of allies and volunteers, a huge survey of their own coworkers in the sector and have come up with some findings that I think will really startle people here and around the country. And this project was in association with food worker organizing groups around the country, nationwide, from farm to plate, grocery, restaurant, agriculture, and so forth. So we really got, for the first time, a comprehensive view of the mostly immigrant workers of color upon which our food system is based. After a lot of heavy lifting, the report is done, or essentially so, and we will be releasing it here in New York. So those New Yorkers are fortunate that you know, they can actually be there at the event. There's going to be unions and worker centers and community groups and food groups are going to converge on June 6th at the New School for the release of the report and some great panels and dialogue about building this food justice movement forward.
And will there be great food there as well?
Of course. You better believe it.
Do you have a website that people go to look up the details on that?
Yeah, foodchainworker.org is the website to go to for that. To connect with our work in New York City's food chain, please go to Focus on the Food Chain on Facebook. You can connect with Brand Workers at brandworkers.org and IWW, our partner, at IWW.org.
Daniel, your work is so inspiring. we're naturally curious about how you got started. I know you're a guild member and very active in the guild, worked on Starbucks campaigns. Can you tell us a bit about your motivations and who inspired you or what inspired you?
Heidi and I are curious. When you first started getting educated about questions of social justice, going back to school days and up through law school, and how you got involved in this, because, you know, we have a segment of our program called Lawyers You're Like, and Heidi and I, we're going to bestow that honor on you, Daniel. Go all the way back, and when did you start getting political?
Well, thank you, Michael and Heidi, for all that you said. I appreciate it. You know, actually, I owe my politicization, if you will, to a company that's now bankrupt. I don't know if that was karma. That was Borders, Books, and Music. I come out of working in retail and fast food at Starbucks, as you mentioned. I had a few bad jobs before I ended up at Borders, but Borders was the first bad job I had that was at a multinational corporation. That was quite jarring because you knew that you had the supervisor that you didn't like and the general manager that was underpaying you, but above them was this superstructure which has so much power over our economic lives, but also our political and social lives with the way the large corporations have hijacked our democracy. So getting upset at work and looking for help was how I was propelled into the labor movement. I wish I could say I was inspired by compassion or some higher aim, but that would be disingenuous. I was driven by anger at my employer, at my paycheck, and at the treatment of my coworkers. And I went out there and, you know, who helps you in these situations? My grandfather actually was a member of the Teamsters Union. He drove a liquor truck here in New York out of the Bronx. So I knew in the back of my mind that he was able to live, you know, the last years of his life as an amazing grandfather with dignity because he had his union pension. But that was more in the back of my mind. So I reached out, and who did I find? The industrial workers of the world.
And had you been out of law school by then?
No, this is long before law school. Yeah.
It's long before college?
This was during college, college
days. So you find the IWW.
Yeah. And the IWW was the only union that would help me. So here we are 10-plus years later, and I'm still a proud member of the industrial workers of the world. But yes, the IWW was the only union interested in helping. I didn't have the patience or the discipline to get much done with respect to Borders. I was very impulsive. I believe justice always had to happen today. Thankfully, I've become a little bit more patient over the years. Fighting Starbucks helped hone my skills because they're such a determined and sophisticated adversary.
Well, that's when we first met you, because our dear friend Len Wineglass was helping you. Len told us about what you were doing, and that was the first time you were on Law and Disorder. But in any case, so now you're working with the IWW, and you're fighting Starbucks, and then what happens next? Have you got out of law school yet?
No, this is before law school. I started at Starbucks in 2003 and worked as a barista, and I learned quite quickly how the company treats its workers. You know, Starbucks is the master, the geniuses, and public relations textbooks, I'm sure, reflect this in snowing the American public about what kind of place it is to work at. The reality is Starbucks is a poverty wage employer. No one's guaranteed any work hours per week. It's extremely difficult to put food on the table, budget for your rent and utilities with that kind of work arrangement. The health care is the big myth at Starbucks. They claim to insure their workforce, but if you look at the numbers, they actually insure a lower percentage of their workers than Walmart. That's because you need to work a certain amount of hours per quarter, and they control the hour scheduling. And then even if you do qualify, you have to purchase health care, and that's difficult to do when you're making $7, $8, $9 an hour and not getting 40 hours a week. So I did begin to meet with my coworkers, and I'm really proud that what we started, that small effort, has now since expanded to around the country, and we have proud red card holding Wobblies at various Starbucks locations who take action, direct action around issues of concern. Most recently, the big victory was winning a holiday pay on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s federal holiday, which Starbucks had been treating as a second class day and not paying the same premium that it paid on other federal holidays. So that was a big win. Seeing the brilliance and frankly, evil brilliance of Starbucks' union-busting operation and the law, and being influenced by my now friend Staunton Lind about his understanding of using the law essentially to keep the law out of the way from workers as they build solidarity and take direct action, rather than seeing the law as some kind of leading tool for workers to use. I ended up going to law school at Fordham here in the city.
And you became a National Lawyers Guild member then.
Absolutely. I'm very proud of my guild membership. Some people might know that before I became a guild member as a lawyer, I was the recipient of the guild's legal observing prowess when I was arrested with a coworker in front of the Starbucks I worked at during the Republican National Convention. I can't even begin to tell you how many videos and sets of notes I was given by the National Lawyers Guild. And as Michael mentioned, I had the really unique pleasure, which I'll remember all my life, to be represented by Guild member Leonard Weinglass. Under his brilliant lawyering and with the Guild's copious evidence, we were really happy to beat the case, which of course was
And what was that case, Daniel?
You know, we were doing a peaceful picket. We had a couple hundred people who were supporting us, baristas, you know, folks who were both local and people in town to protest the Republican National Convention. You know, to be frank, it was an energetic but pretty run-of-the-mill picket. And out of the whole crowd there, there was two people picked out. And that was myself, who was a barista organizer at the store, and my coworker, who was also very active with the union. They picked us out of the crowd. We felt very vindicated when Lenny won the case, and he was asked by a young lawyer that came running up to him, the great Leonard Weinglass, you know, "Mr. Weinglass, how did you win this case for your client?" And Lenny looked at him and said, "My client was innocent." Yeah.
We know you were active during law school, Daniel. What happened after? And give us your overall perspective on Occupy Wall Street and the state of things now.
Yes, I had a good experience in law school. I remember coming from a May Day protest with my picket sign and putting it under the table and taking a law school final with my picket sign under my desk. I was very fortunate at Fordham. I connected with some real luminaries in law and organizing and activism that continue to be important mentors to me to this day, like Jennifer Gordon, the legendary Workplace Project founder, Brian Glick, who's to many people in the Guild a real hero, Martha Rayner, really just tremendous support that I got from faculty and staff as well. Hillary Exter, the great Guild member. After law school, I was really fortunate through the help of so many people, and the Guild really stands very tall. In those earliest days, I was able with some coworkers from the retail and fast food industry to get Brand Workers started in 2007. So we're in our fifth year now. And it's been remarkable to see the organization grow, and we've just been so privileged and honored to work with these immigrant workers in food processing and distribution who we learn from every day, their sense of solidarity, their sense of what's right, and their willingness to fight for justice and dignity in return for their hard work. It's just been absolutely breathtaking to experience. So we're very excited about where the labor movement is at Focus on the Food Chain. We're trying to, I wish we could say innovate, but we're really trying to go back to the early days of the labor movement, where a union was quite simple. It was coworkers fighting together. They were the agents of change, not staff members or bureaucrats employed by an outside force. And that's what we've been trying to prove. With the launch and rise of the Occupy movement, some of these ideas of rank-and-file unionism, direct action, and the general strike itself have become much more in the consciousness, I think, of working families around the country. And so we're very excited and optimistic about the years to come in the labor movement and the workers' rights struggle in general.
How did you build your organization? Do people pay dues? Do their fundraiser? Do you apply for foundation grants? I mean, what do you do to build a grassroots organization like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. First of all, you have to have quite a lot of stamina and willingness to experience a lot of stress, especially in the early years when expenses start immediately and revenues take a lot longer to come in. At Brand Workers, we won't take money from corporations or the government because it's important to us that we remain completely independent from forces that we view as hostile to our members' interests. So we're supported just by, you know, small community foundations and individuals who believe in our work, who believe that the labor movement can go back to this idea that workers themselves are ultimately in a position, the best position, uniquely suited both to change their workplace and also eventually challenge and overcome the corporate system that we all live under. So we've been so lucky to partner with incredible allies, and both in terms of funders and also allies in our day-to-day work. More than anything, I think the track record that our members have chalked up, the determination they've shown to see through campaigns, to overcome retaliation and to win, I think has been refreshing to a lot of people, and it's created a fair amount of goodwill for Brand Workers, which we're grateful for.
We're also inspired by the Occupy movement, which is far from dead, morphing, but out there and with a beating pulse. Where would you like to see things go if you had your druthers?
Well, what's been exciting for Brand Workers in with respect to the Occupy Wall Street mostly has been our involvement in the Immigrant Worker Justice Working Group of the occupation. And that working group is folks, immigrant organizers, workers, and allies who every day in this city fight to build power for working class folks, particularly immigrants. And that working group has helped create more space for recent immigrants of color in particular to lead and participate in Occupy. And it's also helped us on the micro level to build our respective bases, to get our memberships up. I think, you know, there's so many things that tug at our heartstrings in this country that we want to make progress on. I think to make progress on so many of those issues, we're going to need an organized working class. To me, that's the fundamental. If I had to cite one, that will be the foundation of transformational change. And so I think to the extent Occupy can continue playing a role in facilitating increased organization of working class folks on the job and within industries, we're going to see Occupy emerge as an even more relevant and a more powerful force.
You know, I just came to mind a line from IWW poet Ralph Chapin's famous poem, which was turned into the labor's anthem, Solidarity Forever. And, Chapin wrote, when the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there could be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. I think we all like that song, and we like that thought. And we thank you so much, Attorney Daniel Gross, for being on Law and Disorder.
Activist Daniel Gross, thank you so much.
It's always so good to be with you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.